for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Pakistani aircraft targeted Taliban militants and Al-Qaeda fighters near the Afghan border in preparation for a major ground offensive. In the past 8 days, militants have carried out 4 deadly attacks in Pakistan. The latest, a suicide car bomb in a crowded marketplace that killed 41 people. Joining me to talk about the recent violence in Pakistan and the implications for U.S. strategy in the region, Selig Harrison. He's director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy. Robert Grenier, he's former CIA chief of station in Pakistan and director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center in 2005 and 2006. I look forward to hearing your comments. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And don't forget, you can reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Selig Harrison, we've heard this morning about these Pakistan bombings along the Afghan border. Tell us what's going on.
Well, I don't think we can assume that these bombings mean that there's going to be a large-scale ground offensive right away. The question in my mind is whether this is, in a way, a substitute for early action on the ground. It's certainly a way for the armed forces to respond to the provocations of recent days, these terrible terrorist incidents that you mentioned, in particular the attack on the headquarters of the armed forces, which was a remarkable event. They had to do something to save face after that, and they're under a lot of American pressure to move in on the ground in these tribal areas along the Afghan border. So I think that this was essentially a way of saving face after these humiliations of recent days. But they're going to think many times before they move in a big way on the ground, because this is an ethnic problem as well as a problem of Islamist terrorism, because that whole area along the Afghan border is ethnically Pashtun. The Pashtuns don't like the Punjabis who are running the show in Pakistan, in particular running the Pakistan army. And every time there's a military incursion there or a bombing there, it generates terrific Pashtun nationalism against the Punjabis. You could have a kind of ethnic civil war mixed up with an invasion by the Pakistan army. So,
Selig Harrison, he's at the Center for International Policy. Robert Grenier, what do you make of these latest bombings and attacks?
Well, as far as we can tell, it appears that one of the major motivations for the recent terrorist bombings is the apparent imminence of a Pakistani army ground move into South Waziristan. I very much agree with Mr. Harrison, though, that the army seems to be putting off moving forward with this ground offensive, I think in part because they realize this is going to be no easy task.
Now, is the ground offensive coming at the push of the United States?
Well, as Mr. Harrison said, I think that the U.S. government is very much encouraging the Pakistanis to move forward. But I think that Pakistan has its own reasons for doing so. As has been pointed out by the military spokesman, this is the main headquarters, if you will, of the Tehrik-i-Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban. I don't know how they can judge the proportion of recent attacks that have been planned there, but clearly this is a center for them. Having moved the Pakistani Taliban out of the Swat Valley, moving into South Waziristan was the next step.
Robert Grenier, he's chair of ERG Partners Intelligence and Security Industry Consultants. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Sig Harrison, you referred to the Pakistan, the attack on Pakistan's military headquarters as being particularly brazen. Talk about that.
Well, being able to, there was obviously a terrible lapse in security, which is very embarrassing for the armed forces, that permitted these guys to get in there, take hostages, and force the kind of showdown that occurred. And we've now learned that the group that staged this appears to be one of the Punjabi Islamist groups based in the heartland, not the Taliban. And that's particularly ominous because up until now, it has been assumed and believed that the Islamist groups in the Punjab are basically creatures of the army. They were created during the Afghan war to fight against the Russians, and we encouraged this. Then they were used against India in Kashmir, and they've been implicated in the Mumbai terrorist attacks of last November. And everybody, the assumption has been that the ISI had a pretty inner services intelligence in Pakistan had a pretty good leash on the Lashkar-e-Taiba, the Jaish-e-Mohammed, the Sepah-e-Sahaba, these very virulently Islamist groups in the Punjab, which really are much stronger than the Taliban in the border areas. And so now we see a situation where this attack on the armed forces headquarters may well have been, and it seems to have been, conducted by a group based in the Punjab, which would mean that the army is now in a very difficult position. Are they going to try to crack down on this Frankenstein that they've created?
Does it mean necessarily a major change on the part of the Pakistan military in their own approach to these attacks, Robert Grenier?
Well, I think that it has focused their thinking, and they realize that there's no avoiding this fight. I think that they would avoid it if they could. If things change in future, I think that there's still a possibility that they won't follow through. But they realize that the continuation of the state is ultimately at stake, in part because of this amalgamation, this unity of effort, if you will, among the Pashtun-based Pakistani Taliban and these Punjabi extremist groups that Mr. Harrison was just speaking about.
So we are in quite a situation there in that there is fear that the government itself could be overthrown. Is that correct?
Not in the near future, but there certainly is a danger to Pakistan's survival from the strength of these Punjab-based groups in particular. They're much stronger than the Taliban, so-called Taliban groups on the border. And we've got to keep straight in our heads that the Taliban we're fighting in Afghanistan and that Pakistan is supporting is different from what we're now calling the Pakistan Taliban, which it makes it very confusing, I would think, for the average newspaper reader.
Certainly does.
And these Pakistani Taliban groups, I would argue, are not themselves a threat to the Pakistani state. The real danger comes from the fact that there's a big Islamist movement that was created to harass India, to fight against the Russians in Afghanistan by the armed forces right in the heartland of Pakistan, in the Punjab. Those are the groups that would provide the street power if there were ever some closet Islamists in the armed forces who wanted to stage a military coup. And that is, of course, a long-term danger, and that does pose problems with respect to the security of the nuclear arsenal in Pakistan, which at the present time is secure. But if you did have Islamist groups grow, this could be threatened. But I think it's very important to recognize that the American stake in this whole problem of Islamists in Pakistan is connected with our relations with India. The Pakistan is a base for terrorist operations against India as well as operations in Afghanistan. It's all mixed up together, and we've got to make up our minds which side we're on.
Robert Grenier.
Well, I think we also need to see this in a little bit of perspective. I don't think that even the Pakistani-based extremists, whether we're talking about those in the Pashtun-dominated areas or in the Punjab heartland, are on the verge of taking over the state. And let's remember that these are not popular forces. And in fact, there was a real outcry, a real popular revulsion against these groups of both stripes as a result of what happened in the Swat Valley just recently.
But even if there is popular revulsion, as you suggest, does the military have the strength to put down that revulsion on the part of the public?
Well, it's unclear if they have the strength. It's unclear if they have the capability in terms of doctrine
or
ultimately the will. And I think that's something that we need to watch very carefully. Right now, the extremists are taking the fight to the Pakistan military. They're almost forcing them to respond. But if the situation were to change, then and again, if the military were able to avoid this fight, I fear that perhaps they would.
There's another dimension of this which we overlook, and that is what I would call the class war dimension. You know, there's landless labor in Pakistan, and there are big landed interests in Pakistan. And the Pakistan establishment, the government, is basically an alliance of the armed forces, industrial barons, and the feudal landed oligarchy. Now, the Taliban, so-called Pakistani Taliban, these groups based in the northwest frontier, and also the Islamists in the Punjab, all appeal to the landless laborers. Mm. And that's frightened the leadership in Pakistan as much as the Islamist extremism.
But the question would be, how large do you see this oligarchy to actually be in terms of percentage of the population?
Well, in terms of numbers, it's a small group at the top, but it's unfortunately the so-called democracy in Pakistan has been very narrowly based, and the groups that even at the present time after the recent elections, you don't have a really broad-based democratic government in Pakistan.
Selig Harrison, he's director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy. When we come back, we'll talk further, take your calls, stay with us. We're joined now by Michael Crepon. He's in Charlottesville, Virginia. He's founding president of the Henry L. Stimson Center and diplomat scholar at the University of Virginia. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
I know that recently you met with Pakistani nuclear scientists. Tell us what you learned.
I work with the military guys who are in charge of the nuclear program. So I don't have access to folks like AQ Khan, like the rest of my fellow U.S. citizens. The military that are working nuclear issues are serious about it, and I suspect, and I think they're doing a very good job of protecting the crown jewels of the country.
But to what extent would you say this recent attack on the military headquarters in Pakistan raised new concerns about the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons?
Diane, the way the Pakistanis approach this problem is not that dissimilar from other countries. You look at the threat that could be posed to military installations where you keep your crown jewels, and you design your defense against that threat. Now, what the Pakistan military are likely to do, in my judgment, after the attacks on General Headquarters, is to take another look at their projected threats. So, for example, do I need to defend this installation against 10 men with automatic weapons that are getting help from one or two people inside? That's one approach to a problem. What the Pakistani military have to go back and do now is to say, is this the right-sized threat? Maybe we have to design against 20 people with automatic weapons, getting help from three people inside, and make adjustments accordingly. Hmm. But they're very serious about this, Diane, and they'll do what it takes to protect their crown jewels.
It's interesting. We've had a couple of emails. One caller says the root cause is the Pakistan army itself creating this monster, double-crossing the world and America. They are supporting the Taliban, especially in southern Punjab. Sig Harrison.
Well, they certainly are supporting the Taliban forces in Afghanistan that are contributing to the deaths of American soldiers there. But in the Punjab, you don't have the Taliban. You have other Islamist groups that certainly the Army Inter-Services Intelligence has built up over the years. And this is the essence of the problem. And what's most interesting about this attack on the headquarters is that there seem to be some groups from those forces in the Punjab involved. And that must be giving the guys in the Army headquarters sleepless nights, because now they have to decide, are they going to go into the encampments of Lashkar-e-Taiba at Maridki in the Punjab and break it up and disarm the Lashkar-e-Taiba and risk a great deal of retaliation, right, kind of a pitched battle, or not? And that's really what's required now, I think.
Another caller says, we in America do not grasp that in most of Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's God, family, tribe, then country. In order of allegiance, government loyalty is far down the scale. Robert Grenier.
Well, I think that's certainly true in the tribal areas, and that's something that the Pakistan government has had to struggle with since time immemorial, since the founding of the republic. I think elsewhere in the country, the structure of people's loyalties is somewhat different. But I think that those are the two Pakistans that are essentially in conflict with one another.
And here is a message on Facebook. He says, I want to tell the American public that this war in Pakistan is too complicated. It's creating more hate against America and more terrorists. I wish the Obama administration would make wise policies and contact the sincere people in Pakistan. The government itself is way too corrupt. Sig Harrison.
Now, there's a great deal to that. It seems to me that we do have a much too high profile in Pakistan, and we certainly shouldn't be pushing the army into going into Waziristan, a Pashtun area, pushing a Punjabi army to go into a Pashtun area and embark on what really is going to become an ethnic civil war in Pakistan. It's not just a problem of the terrorists and the Islamists in that area. This is all mixed up with the conflict between the Pashtuns, who don't want to be dominated by the Punjabis. The central government is now, you know, when the British were running that part of the world, they gave autonomy to these tribal areas. And so did the new government of Pakistan until 9/11, when we said to the Pakistan government, get in there, go in there, root out all these Al-Qaeda guys and all these terrorists. Well, the trouble is we were quite oblivious to what the implications of this were, because now what we stirred up is a big animosity between the Pashtuns and the central government of Pakistan, and I think the Waziristan ground offensive will only make it worse.
Diane, this is Michael. Could I
intervene here? Go right ahead.
I disagree with Sig Harrison on this. The Army has been telegraphing a move in South Waziristan for some time. If they pull back from it now, I think it's going to have significant consequences. The Army is working, in effect, the flanks problem in Waziristan, by which they mean, unlike typical military nomenclature, they are doing deals with some of the tribes in Waziristan. So it's not a confrontation between the Army and the Pashtuns. They are trying to isolate the bad guys in South Waziristan. They're softening them up with airstrikes now. If they don't follow up on the ground, I think there are going to be terrible consequences.
Robert Grenier.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with Michael on this. I think that Pakistan does have to move forward. They do have to react to this. These attacks by the Pakistani Taliban have been beyond the pale. It has always been part of the government policy, whether it was the British Raj before or the government of Pakistan now, that they have to punish situations where militants strike at the heart of the state. Also, part of what the Pakistan Army is doing and that we don't see very clearly right now is precisely what Michael has been describing, and that is appealing to elements in the tribal territory, specifically South Waziristan, who are not allied with the Massoud. Right now, that the key militants who have been pushing this campaign against the government and against civilian areas have been from the Massoud tribe.
What about the American drone attacks and how they fit into this whole picture as those drones hit, following up on the assertions that the Taliban and the Afghan Taliban leaders are hiding there in Pakistan?
Well, this too is a very complicated picture because the drones are a very effective weapon in striking at specific leadership elements, whether it's Al-Qaeda elements, whether it's leadership elements.
But they're also killing civilians as
well. They're also killing civilians,
yes.
And they also offend the pride of Pakistanis of virtually all stripes, because they don't like seeing a foreign power coming in, moving and using military power with impunity within their borders. So this is very much a two-sided sword, if you will.
All you're going to get if we encourage them to go in there is an escalating cycle of violence that will really will not end the problem, but make the problem worse.
So what would
but
you
because
do?
Because the point is that the attacks of recent days and weeks have been retaliatory attacks. They've been vengeance. In the Pashtun code, Pashtun Wali, you've got to get vengeance. And so most of the trouble in the last month has been a result of what went before.
Would you agree, Robert Grenier?
Well, I think it works both ways. Yes, it's true that there's a reaction now to the recent killing of Baitullah Massoud, the head of the Pakistani Taliban. But now, according to that same Pashtun Wali code, the Pakistan Army has to respond to some of the outrages that have been committed by these militants.
All right. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Dave. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good. I wanted to comment on sort of the blending that I see between Afghanistan and Pakistan in terms of the tribal factions. I mean, our biggest struggle for the United States and Afghanistan is trying to unite the government in a society that's full of tribal factions. And I kind of see the same thing happening in Pakistan. You 6 months ago, heard about the Pashtun issue, and now you're seeing the Punjab extremists come into the picture, and you see this fragmentation of the government in general. Excuse me. So, long term, if there's a destabilization in Pakistan, and you wind up with an even wider sort of tribal factionalism, you know, that's going to be a threat because of the nuclear problem, sure. But what about the whole strategy of the United States in the region in that scenario?
Sig Harrison.
I think we should look at these two problems separately. The problem, the Pakistan is connected to the Afghan problem in one way, and that is that Pakistan's intelligence wants to keep the Taliban strong because they want it to be a major player in the future of Afghanistan. That means the insurgency will go on, and we will be getting casualties as long as that continues. And the Taliban is strong. It's a Pashtun movement in Afghanistan. You've got Pashtuns on both sides of this border. And so you have the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan being the Pashtuns. And yet, ironically, when we went in there after 9/11, we connived in installing a government dominated by the ethnic minority Tajiks, who run the intelligence, the army, secret police. We can't build up an army to get out of Afghanistan and take our job over because it's the army now is dominated by Tajiks, 70% of the battalion commanders. You can't get the Pashtuns in the Pashtun areas to join the army. So I think we have there's an interconnection in the sense that you've got Pashtuns on both sides of the border. But the two problems are really, I think, much more separate than we acknowledge.
Diane, I think there's a danger here of getting lost in the weeds. Here's the big picture. The big picture is that the Pakistan security establishment, which has been guilty of multiple sins in the past, has now had a profound recognition that the groups that they have been feeding to do damage against India in the past and to protect their interests in Afghanistan have turned against them. And we see this not just in the strikes at General Headquarters, but there is a profound recognition in the country as a whole that these groups represent a threat to the state. And therefore, the army is beginning to turn against these groups. It can't turn against them all at the same time. This has to be done sequentially.
All right. At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Arlington, Texas. Good morning, Danny. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, all. Diane, I love you. Love your show.
Thank you.
Quick observation. We could sit here and talk and split hairs who is involved. From the end result is every heavy involvement by the American military, the cost, and the result of it is increased civilian casualties and more suicide bombing. It's like we have created a whole generation of suicide bombers.
It's interesting because David Ignatius wrote in the Washington Post over the weekend about the backlash to the United States that the U.S. aid, the U.S. involvement has created there in Pakistan. Robert Grenier.
Well, I think that in this latest instance, the one that David Ignatius was describing, the backlash is from the army and the political classes in Pakistan because we have attached so much fine print to this very generous offer of economic support that, again, it has offended national pride. They think that it is impinging on their sovereignty.
Diane, let me give you a very specific example.
Sure.
Kerry Lugar bill. The bill contains language that encourages civilian oversight of the armed forces, and there's nothing wrong with that. That would be good. But the bill specifically suggests that the political masters in Pakistan get involved in the army promotions process. Now, nothing could be more counterproductive. In this society, do you want a politician saying, I'd like my cousin to be promoted to become a lieutenant general? This it's well-meaning, but it's going to have a profoundly negative effect. And the army is reacting very strenuously to this language.
Well, that's a very good point. I think we should also recognize, though, that the United States is providing $800 million a year in cash subsidies to the armed forces. This is in addition to airplanes and specific military aid that Congress approves. And these cash subsidies, much of them haven't even been monitored very carefully, and a lot of the weaponry purchased with it is directed against India, not against the Taliban. We're in a situation where we're subsidizing the army, and so we are very much involved in the military-civilian balance in Pakistan. We have built up an armed force over the last 50 years of aid at different times, Cold War aid of different kinds. The army now has $38 billion in economic enterprises, $38 billion in assets in economic enterprises of all kinds. Most people don't recognize that. It's a privileged elite. It dominates and smothers Pakistan. So anything we can do...
It's also defending Pakistan from enemies on the inside.
All right. We've got to take just a short break here. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with your calls, your email, your messages from Facebook, and your tweets. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, by the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Immigration remains a hot-button issue across the U.S., but the personal stories of many of today's newcomers illustrate how they contribute to America's strength. The Immigrant Experience in the U.S. Today, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Question for all of you, and I'll start with you, Robert Grenier. What has the U.S. accomplished so far in Pakistan?
Well, I think that we have provided the Pakistanis with a good deal of financial support, both for the military and to some degree for the economy. That is set to increase, as we've just been discussing. I think more profoundly, from the point of view of U.S. interests and U.S. policy, we have succeeded in encouraging the Pakistanis to get into the fight against militancy. We have encouraged them to some degree to begin to recognize what we've been describing here, and that is the fact that all of these different extremist groups, for all that we need to make distinctions among them, at the end of the day are reinforcing one another, and that Pakistan, in order to counter some, must attack all.
Same question for you, Michael Crapon. What has the U.S. accomplished?
I think we have helped Pakistan shift its security focus. from an external threat to an internal threat. And we are now helping the Army address that threat. That is job number one for the for our future relationship with Pakistan.
Sig Harrison.
We've kept Pakistan afloat. And there wouldn't be a Pakistani state that was economically viable at all now if it weren't for the subsidies provided by the United States since 9/11. There are $15 billion in foreign debt that we've rescheduled. We've carried out, we've encouraged the IMF and the international aid donors to aid Pakistan. There wouldn't be any solvent Pakistan operating if it weren't for our continuing economic subsidies and support. And we are bankrolling the Army to the tune of almost $1 billion a year in cash subsidies. At the same time, Pakistan is aiding the Taliban in Afghanistan, which is killing Americans. There's something wrong with this picture. And it seems to me that we have to continue policies that enable Pakistan to be as stable as possible. But we're so economic aid, which a lot of which we've given, has been very constructive in various sections of development in Pakistan. It's an important third world country. Kerry Lugar bill's good in the sense that we should be giving them economic aid. But we're over involved in the whole military security side in Pakistan. They've got to sort these problems out internally.
And what does all that mean in regard to U.S. policy in Afghanistan?
It means we're stuck there permanently, or indefinitely, I guess is the right word, unless we can get the Quetta Shura, the headquarters of the Taliban in Afghanistan, decommissioned in Pakistan, unless we can get the Pakistan to stop its aid and support to the Taliban in Afghanistan. All this debate about our Afghan policy is really meaningless if we're not willing to confront Pakistan and get it to stop aiding the Taliban.
How long would you personally keep troops, U.S. troops, in Afghanistan?
Well, you have to have a strategy for extricating the United States and NATO from Afghanistan that doesn't turn the place over to the Afghan Taliban. I think we could have such a strategy if we brought other countries in. We've bitten off more than we can chew. We have regional countries that, as Henry Kissinger pointed out in Newsweek this week, that all have a stake in keeping the Taliban out of power in Afghanistan. India, Russia, China, Iran, Tajikistan. We've got to have a series of international conferences that bring all of them into the picture. I would think 3 or 4 years process of U.S. disengagement in which we continue to defend the major cities and the highways, because we don't want a Taliban takeover. We've got to have peace agreements with the Taliban at the local level, as General Petraeus and General McChrystal have envisaged in their various assessments, local peace deals. But you can't have those peace deals unless you set a timetable for getting out.
Robert Grenier.
Well, I think that Selig Harrison has painted a picture which is actually more stark than the truth. We depended absolutely on Pakistan to provide us with a platform so that we could sort things out in Afghanistan after 9/11. It was arguably against Pakistan's interest to do so. They did provide us with that platform, however. They gave us support. And yes, we have been subsidizing them since, but that has been part of the deal that we've struck with them. With regard to their current relationship with the Afghan Taliban, yes, it is a very ambiguous one. I don't think that they are outright supporting them. I don't think they're giving them military supplies and support and training and that sort of thing. However, they do tolerate their presence. There's no question about that. And part of the reason for that is that Pakistan has some very clear national interests in Afghanistan, which we are not particularly helping them to achieve. They see the government in Kabul as working against their interests, and so they're trying to hedge their bets, in effect, by maintaining a relationship with the Afghan Taliban. We're going to have to address clear Pakistani national interests if we are going to drive a real wedge between them and the Afghan Taliban.
All right, let's go now to Putney, Vermont. Cedric, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello. Go right ahead, sir.
Yes. Is this I'm terribly sorry. My memory is very bad because of my age. This is the radio?
Yes, sir, it is. Thank you for your call. Let's go now to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Diane. Just a wonderful show, and you're a wonderful person.
Thank you.
Listen, I have heard about a second siege beyond the 22-hour siege at the main headquarters that took place as a battle between Pakistani paramilitary forces and a second group of insurgents for control of a road tunnel that connects the towns of Dara Adam Kell and Kohat in the northwest frontier province. And supposedly the town of Kohat and the Wa Cantonment Pakistani Ordnance Complex in the city of Kamra are the keys to Pakistan's nuclear missile arsenals. And at the time, it has been said that the fall of the town of Kohat and that tunnel would cut to the Taliban, would cut off Islamabad and the Pakistani high command from Kamra, the city of Kamra, and its nuclear arsenal. And this actually appeared to be the object of the Taliban push on the tunnel road, coupled with the assault on military headquarters. And even though both of the top generals for Pakistan said there's no conceivable scenario, political or violent, in which Pakistan will fall to extremists or the nuclear arsenals will fall to Taliban or Al-Qaeda types, I'm just wondering what your guests think about kind of the whole plan to attack the headquarters and whether that could have been to destabilize some of the logistical command and control to a lot of these Pakistani arsenals.
Patrick, hold on a minute. Yes. Tell me where your information comes from.
I'm reading from a website called Debta that quoted two of the Pakistani generals talking about the scenario and what exactly happened on Sunday. And it also says on here that Pakistan's preparing a 100,000 men push for an offensive against Taliban and Al-Qaeda strongholds, and that this was a message to send back to the Pakistani leadership that if they do that, then the Taliban is going to attack the cities.
All right. Robert Grenier.
Well, I think that the caller's geography is a little bit mistaken here. I'm not aware of an attempt to seize the tunnel that he's just described. And yes, it does control routes from Kohat for the south in the direction of Dar Adam Khel. But the Wa Cantonment that he described, which is an important military facility, is actually much closer to Islamabad, and that tunnel doesn't really affect the logistical lines there. With regard to the larger issue, however, and that is, you know, what was the intent behind this attack on the general headquarters? And I think essentially this was an effort to pass a message to show that you are not safe anywhere, that the reach of the Taliban does span the country, and that the Pakistan army is not invincible. And I think that symbolically they've succeeded in doing that.
What we've got is a cycle of violence. The troubles of the last weeks have been primarily a response to a whole series of what the Pashtuns feel have been provocations against them. And it goes back to the storming of the Red Mosque during the time of Musharraf, when a lot of hundreds of young Pashtun women, students in that madrasa, were killed. The death of Baitullah Masood, which we've hailed as a great victory. The Pashtun Wali Code says you got to wreak vengeance. So what's been happening in the last few weeks is a result of what happened before. And the problem now is to calm things down, not to make it worse.
How do you do that, though? How do you calm things down with the American presence being resented and yet part of the push by the Pakistani military is because the U.S. is there?
Diane, these attacks, not just on General Headquarters, but on the UN World Food Program Office and elsewhere, are clarifying for most Pakistanis that there is an internal security problem that has to be addressed. And it can't be addressed by turning the other cheek. And it's clarifying for the people of Pakistan, most of them, that the only way, the only vehicle to protect the interests of the country are the armed forces. So the armed forces do need support. there are complicating issues. Pakistan is a complicated place.
But the armed forces themselves may not be trustworthy. Robert Grenier.
Well, the armed forces at the end of the day are going to do what they think is in the interest of Pakistan, and they also have parochial interests of their own as well. But I think that as we discuss this issue, we really need to decide fundamentally what is it that we want. Now, yes, it's true. We could encourage the Pakistanis to unwind this cycle of violence. We could try to calm things down. But where would that get us? That would get us at a point where the Pakistanis would continue to tolerate the presence of the Quetta Shura and the leadership of the Afghan Taliban.
So you're saying that this violence should escalate and continue.
We want the Pakistanis to confront Islamic extremism in the many forms that it exists in their part of the world. The Islamic extremists are not going to take this lying down. There's a certain period of violence that they're going to have to go through, and in fact, we need to encourage them to see it through.
The Quetta Shura, we certainly have to put continuing pressure on Pakistan to shut down the Quetta Shura to stop its aid to the Afghan Taliban. This is a different problem from the Pashtun groups like the Tehrik-i Taliban in the tribal areas. That's a problem Pakistan, for reasons that Michael and Richard have explained, will deal with on its own. We don't need an American guiding hand.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Michael, you want to get in there?
Diane, it's taken the better part of a decade to convince Pakistan's security establishment to correct prior mistakes. They've made egregious errors in judgment, and now they're paying the price. But they have to see this through. And the focus has to be on Pakistan itself. Sig keeps talking about Pakistan's support for folks in Afghanistan. The issue today is what's going on in Pakistan and whether or not the security forces will go after the folks they once provided sustenance to. And it started. And once this kind of military action happens, there's going to be blowback. And now the blowback is on the Pakistani society itself. It's very upsetting and unfortunate. The country is choked with the consequences of its prior support for militancy. Mm. You go around Pakistan and the security levels are huge and choking. The economy is choking because of prior support for militancy. And people are beginning to get it. And they're taking steps to deal with it.
What kinds of steps?
Well, you're seeing military strikes, air strikes against Waziristan, and I suspect ground action will follow. You saw the military go into Swat, which is a settled area adjacent to these tribal areas where the Taliban have taken hold and have been expulsed. So, and there are consequences to that. So people are still suicide bombing is simple in Pakistan.
I think Michael's
will remain vulnerable. But the actions and the reactions are part of a cycle where the security forces are now trying to take back the state.
All right, Sig Harrison.
But Michael, don't forget that the anti-American climate in Pakistan is growing all the time. And the problem for the United States, there's things we can say behind the scenes to all of the actors in Pakistan, but the whole patronizing tone of what you're saying, that we know what's best for Pakistan and we know what makes what the military should do. This tone is exactly what our problem is in Pakistan.
The patronizing tone you speak of, Sig, is in the language of the Kerry Lugar bill. It's certainly not my language. I respect the security concerns of the Pakistani military establishment. I am grateful that they finally seeing the light and are acting on longstanding problems. We ought not to be suggesting at this stage of the cycle of violence for the Pakistani military establishment either to take a break or refocus on Afghanistan. They need to focus on their own country.
All right, I'm going to give you the last word, Robert Grenier.
Well, I think that we need to be able to distinguish between what are U.S. interests and what are Pakistani interests. I think that, as Michael has pointed out, over time there's a greater convergence and there's a greater recognition on the part of the Pakistanis that there is a convergence of interests between us. As we are focusing on Islamic extremism primarily in Afghanistan, they are focusing on Islamic extremism at home. They still see some distinctions there. They don't see an identity of purpose with us, but over time we need to encourage that identity.
And, of course, we haven't even mentioned that Osama bin Laden is still at large. Robert Grenier, Selig Harrison, Michael Crepon, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.